The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
It's good to be back. I had a nice week teaching a retreat, but it's nice to be back. Tonight I'd like to talk a little bit about essentially what the Buddha saw as the problem he was trying to address with his teaching. After he woke up, after he was enlightened, after he had his deep realization, one of the things he recognized or realized was that although human beings wish to not suffer, they do the very things that they engage in, the very things that actually create their own suffering. And that out of compassion, he wanted to let people know what he had learned about suffering and the structure of how suffering happens. So this teaching on suffering, the Pali term that is used for this is dukkha, and it's often translated as suffering, but that the term actually refers to something that's quite a bit broader than just what we normally think of as suffering. Some other people have translated it with different terms. Stress is one that Tan Jeff likes to use, Tanisaro Bhikkhu, and that's a pretty good translation because it indicates kind of the subtlety of what is meant by this term. But it stress sometimes doesn't convey the severity that we can experience in suffering, and so you know, a range of terms, dissatisfaction, stress, unease. So the Buddha was essentially trying to help people to understand their causes of suffering, how and why suffering happens for us. So in a way, he kind of approached this problem and he approached this notion of waking up, of liberation, of enlightenment in a very different way than the other teachers of his time. That he wasn't looking for some kind of mystical transcendent state. He was looking for how to solve a very practical issue in our day-to-day lives. What is suffering? How does it arise? How can it end? And that for him is the whole path. That how we engage with that, if we engage skillfully with that understanding how our suffering comes to be, then it leads us in a direction that actually ends up feeling quite transcendent, the state of non-suffering, according to the Buddha, is what he calls nibbana, enlightenment. So this path is essentially, to me, this is such a beautiful exploration, because basically what he's talking about is meeting our day-to-day experience, meeting our lives moment to moment, not trying to transcend it through some altered state, but just meeting, right, directly touching our experience. And when we touch our experience, often what we meet is stress, it's suffering. And so, turning to look at that. In his teaching on suffering. His, the first noble truth is essentially an exploration of this truth of stress, of suffering, the truth of dukkha. He said that this suffering, this stress, should be understood. That that's what we need to take some action around this dukkha. Not to just kind of think about it, not to just meet it and kind of be rolled over by it, but to understand it. And this understanding that he's talking about is not an intellectual understanding, but a direct meeting of the understanding of how it unfolds moment to moment. And the place we can understand that is in the present moment with mindfulness, meeting our experience. And so this is about turning towards our experience of stress, of suffering, not trying to get around it or to manipulate the world to fix it or change it, but to turn towards it and actually acknowledge it. Yes, this is stress, this is suffering. How does this impact the body? How does it impact the mind? So this is this teaching on understanding this stress, this suffering. So in the kind of range or breadth of experience that is encompassed by this term dukkha, encompassed by the what the Buddha was talking about with respect to suffering, he acknowledged this range by describing three different kinds of dukkha. That there's a dukkha that's due to pain, due to physical and mental pain. This is kind of the obvious kind of suffering that we experience. And then there's what he called the dukkha due to change. That because experience, because everything changes, there's a kind of a stress, a suffering around that change. And then there's what he called the dukkha of existence, just the stress of being alive, essentially. And in a way, we can think of these as kind of going from the most obvious kinds of suffering to some more subtle kinds of suffering, almost as if it's layers of this stress or suffering. That as we explore our experience through our mindfulness practice, at first when we meet suffering, it's likely to be a kind of an obvious suffering in this realm of the dukkha of pain. But over time, we'll start to see the subtler levels of suffering around holding on to trying to keep things from changing. And then the even subtler levels of suffering around just the what we have to do to be alive. So mostly what I'd like to talk about tonight is this teaching on these different kinds of suffering, these different kinds of stress, as an exploration of this term, dukkha, to kind of get a sense of how broad it is and ways to meet the different kinds of stress and ways that we fool ourselves into thinking that we're not suffering when we actually are. Because it actually seems to me that there are many times when we're experiencing some kind of suffering and we're not aware of that. Kind of like it's masked in a way, that we're not aware of the level of suffering or stress that we're under because we're focused on things outside of us. So the first kind that the Buddha talked about, the most obvious kind of suffering is the dukkha due to pain. The term for this in Pali is dukkha-dukkha. Dukkha, dukkha. Yes, double your dukkha. So this is the kind of dukkha that, we're not likely to miss. This is the kind of dukkha that's kind of staring us in the face. It's the suffering that's due to unpleasant physical and mental experience. And in general, with this kind of dukkha, an unpleasant experience is the springboard for the suffering. Now, unpleasant experience is going to happen to us. And if we look at our lives, we're going to experience pleasant experience, we're going to experience unpleasant experience, and there's going to be some neutral things. And this range of what we can call feeling tone is something that happens to us with every experience. We experience a sight, and there's a pleasantness or unpleasantness or neutrality to that sight. We experience a physical sensation, and there's a pleasantness and unpleasantness or neutrality to that physical sensation. And in our mental life, thoughts, emotions, moods also have this quality of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And it's this quality of being pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral that actually serves as the springboard for our response, our reactivity. So this pleasant, unpleasant, neutral experience is kind of a given in our world. But what happens to us is that when we meet something unpleasant, we don't like it. This is our kind of habitual process. And the way, essentially, that this dukkha is born, that when we have an unpleasant experience, it leads to a not liking, a not wanting, a wanting to get rid of, a rejection, aversion, a wanting things to be other than they are. And essentially there's kind of a positive feedback loop that happens, because the feeling of rejection, the feeling of not liking, the feeling of not wanting is an unpleasant experience. And so there's an unpleasant reaction to an unpleasant experience, which compounds the unpleasantness, and it kind of quickly spirals into a kind of a runaway chain reaction. And this is how, essentially, this kind of dukkha due to pain, gets started. So, for example, just take a simple example. We might have reactivity to physical experience. We have a headache. There's a pain in our head. And there's the pain. There's the pain that's going on. We can't deny that there's the pain. But then on top of that, we often add a whole bunch of pressure and tension. Maybe there's some kind of even tightening or squeezing physically that we do to try to, squinting our eyes or... So there can be some physical reactions, and often there's kind of some mental reactivity that happens. I can't handle this headache. I've got to do a presentation this afternoon. What am I going to do? And so there's that mental reactivity that follows on that physical unpleasantness. So not only do we react to our physical experience through reactivity, we also react to our mental experience through reactivity. So an unpleasant mental experience, we might, for instance, have something like a thought, this person doesn't like me. Now that thought itself is actually, believe it or not, it's actually neutral. That thought arises in the mind. It's just an expression of words, just this person doesn't like me. And then there's some kind of belief or something that is merged in with that thought. If there's a belief that that person doesn't like you, there may become that flavor of an unpleasant experience in the mind. So there's that unpleasantness of this thought that this person doesn't like you, and there's a believing of that thought. And then there may be some subsequent reactions to that. That you want that person to like you, or you feel like, well, I wouldn't want that person to like me anyway. And there's kind of a blossoming again of reactivity to something happening in our minds. So this kind of dukkha encompasses a whole range of emotions, actually, from more subtle like dislike to anger, hatred, rage, to maybe some more subtle frustration or irritation. So all of these states come within this realm of the dukkha due to pain. Now the key here to recognize is that it's actually not the unpleasant experience itself that is the suffering. There's the unpleasantness, and it may seem hard to believe, but it's actually possible to experience unpleasantness without any reactivity in the mind whatsoever. So there can be a physical pain in the body and no reactivity whatsoever to that physical pain. If you can imagine that, how that might be, you know, if you have a headache and there's absolutely no reactivity to that headache at all, it's not a problem. So the notion of dukkha, this notion of suffering that the Buddha is talking about, is essentially the creation of problems in our world, in our lives. The dukkha is about the problem-creating nature of our minds. If there's no reactivity, there's no problem, there's no dukkha, there's no suffering. There is the physical pain. So this teaching around being free of suffering in the Buddhist teaching, which is this essentially, I mean, I'm talking about this not as a downer. I mean, it may sound like a downer here talking about suffering for 45 minutes, but actually I'm hoping that it will be, I mean, the Buddha talked about this not as a downer, but because he said, look, it's possible to be free from this. This is possible. We don't have to be whipped around by our reactions. We don't have to react to pleasant and unpleasant. We can live a life of balance of mind. So that's, I think that's the great news. I mean, it takes a radical shift of our relationship to what we're experiencing. Because typically when we're experiencing suffering, particularly this obvious kind of suffering, our habitual tendency is to turn out in the world to try to fix things, try to arrange things, change things, so that whatever it is that's unpleasant out there goes away. Or that we get ourselves out of the situation so that we're no longer in the space of that unpleasant situation. So this brings me to kind of how we mask this kind of dukkha. And often this kind of dukkha, this dukkha, is pretty obvious to us. I mean, when we're feeling angry or frustrated or irritated, there's that kind of feeling that feels like something's wrong here. I got to fix something. And so that there's a sense that there is some suffering happening often. But sometimes it can be masked by that very movement to fix or change the world. So for instance, you know, what might happen is there's something unpleasant in the world and there's a little bit of stress, a little bit of not liking it, of wanting to fix it. You know, there's that little bit of stress that's there. But immediately what our minds might do is to create an idea in our minds about what the world will be like when we get rid of this thing. So essentially we create a fantasy in our minds. And that fantasy is pleasant. So we've created something in our experience. The mind has created something in our experience that's pleasant. And we're kind of focused on that, as opposed to the actuality of this thing in our world and our kind of subtle tension and pressure around it. So in a way, that tension and pressure, the stress of that unpleasantness, is masked by having this fantasy in our minds about what it's going to be like when we fix this situation. Or we are so focused outward on the world that we are not paying attention to what we're actually feeling. For myself, I had a clear example of this at one point in my early practice. I was really, really angry with somebody. And initially, I was kind of, you know, I kind of found that the mind was kind of projected out towards that person I was angry with. And somehow believing or thinking that the anger was going to hurt him. And while I was in that revenge mode, I wasn't so aware of my own suffering, of my own state of suffering around the feeling of anger. But I was actually fortunate in this situation in that the person that I was angry with was more than 7,000 miles away. And it became pretty clear that, you know, he wasn't going to suffer because I was angry. But I was really suffering. You know, so I saw that belief in a way that somehow this anger would like lash out at him. You know, there's a classic analogy of anger in the text that it's like picking up a hot coal to throw at somebody so that you can burn them. But the trouble is you're burned first. But being so focused on the, you know, lashing out at them, you may not even notice that it's burning you. So the turning our attention to the world out there, what can we fix, what can we change, how can we get back at people, sometimes it masks our own suffering of these states that are present in our experience here and now. So the experience of not liking, not wanting, aversion, anger, frustration, irritation, hatred, all of those actually cause a state of the state of dukkha, the state of suffering, here and now in our experience. So the turning to meet this kind of suffering is the practice of understanding it. So the Buddha suggested turn with mindfulness to the feeling. When we actually meet the feelings, you know, our upbringing has probably taught us, well, if you meet the feeling of anger, suppress it. You know, if you feel that, suppress it. Don't go there. And that's not what this teaching suggests. It suggests kind of a middle path, a middle way between acting out on the anger and repressing it. So we don't act out on the anger, but we also don't repress it. Instead, we turn and meet it, acknowledge it with mindfulness, feel it, feel what it's like in the body. What does the mind do with this? So it can seem counterintuitive to do this, to turn and meet our suffering like this. Why? Why would we want to do this? What we start to see as we turn to meet our suffering, our dukkha, is that there's a bunch of things we actually start to see. If we're just willing to hang out in the space of that suffering, we start to see this positive feedback loop I was talking about, how the reactivity to reactivity, you know, we have the experience of something happening in the world and we react to that with some kind of emotion, and then we react to that with some kind of emotion, and then there's another emotion and another emotion, and there's just layer after layer of emotional reactivity. And we start to see how this runaway train works in our mind. And when we turn with mindfulness, it begins to kind of put a halt to that runaway train, and we can just land here in this moment with whatever is happening. It may be strong anger, but we can actually meet that. So another thing we start to understand is how our own minds contribute to this problem of reactivity. That there's things in the world that happen, and then there's you know, we're here in inside, we're bringing our causes and conditions, our upbringing, our history, our you know, everything that's happened to us to this point, we bring all of that to the present moment and we meet conditions in the world. And because of that interface, that particular interface has certain triggers, certain ways of being contracted around certain experiences. If we had a different upbringing, it might be different. We might have different reactivity. So we start to see that the suffering that we experience is a result of a kind of a combination of processes, and that actually a large part of it is coming from the way our mind is reacting to experience. We also see that as we turn with mindfulness to our experience, that it gives us a little bit of space around the reactivity. And we begin to see that often our reactivity diminishes with this mindfulness. So try it for yourself. And what happens as you turn towards experience with mindfulness? Now you might ask, what's wrong with trying to fix something that's difficult for us? You know, why should I just sit here and pay attention to my reactivity instead of trying to do something to fix things? There's a couple of things about this. One is that when we're in the mode of something happens, we want to fix it. Often that wanting to fix is coming out of an aversive push. You know, it's like, ugh, don't like that, gotta fix it. So there's a kind of an aversion that's present in the wanting to fix. And acting on that aversion, if we follow through on that aversion, it essentially conditions in our mind that acting on aversion is the way to solve our problems. That's the way that we can fix things, you know. Act on aversion, fix the problem, things will be okay. And it conditions future reactivity in that way. It's kind of like, well, it worked once, so maybe if I don't like this and fix it, it'll work again. So it conditions a kind of a future aversion. So it keeps us in this cycle of reactivity, essentially. And this is one of the things that the Buddha was pointing to when he said he saw beings engaging in just the thing, thinking they were making themselves happy, thinking they were going to be making themselves happy, they were engaging in just the thing that was actually linking them to more and more suffering. This is the kind of thing he was pointing to. That out of aversion, we try to fix, control, manipulate the world. Another piece of this is that in large measure, if we weren't reacting with aversion to something, we wouldn't have to fix it. It's the reaction that's the problem. It's not the thing in the world that's the problem. To a lot of what's happening to us, a large part of what's happening to us, the vast majority of things actually don't need to be fixed. It's really simply our response to them. There does need to be some discernment, however. I mean, there are times when if, you know, you're in a situation where somebody is causing you physical harm or psychological harm, there are ways in which to change the situation or get yourself out of the situation that don't involve this aversion. Now, this is a challenge. I mean, it's because we're so habituated to responding with aversion, that's our normal way of reacting to situations where there's unpleasantness. But we can reframe it. We can turn more towards the heart of compassion in acting to remove ourselves from suffering, to stop somebody from harming somebody. That's a movement of compassion. And if we can connect to that movement of compassion rather than that movement of aversion, it cultivates more of a release of the heart than a contraction of the heart. So we don't have to simply sit back and say, you know, oh, you know, I'm just supposed to watch my reactivity. I'm not supposed to do anything in the world. But what we are asked to do is to see if we can reframe our motivation for acting from one of greed, aversion, and delusion to one of compassion, of generosity, of kindness. I'm of two minds right now. I could go on and talk more about the next other two kinds of suffering, or I could open it up for conversation. Are there any questions or thoughts or explorations that people are interested in having around this first kind of suffering that I've been talking about?
So I have a question, Andrea. Sometimes when one turns to face the suffering, the dukkha that they're experiencing, many people report that it seems to just amp it up. And then they get lost in the fact that it just seems to increase. And so they, and I've had this experience as well of thinking, you know, why go there? It's just so intense.
Yes.
So would you comment on that?
Yes, that's a really good point. Sometimes, especially as we're just beginning this exploration around turning towards, particularly when something is strong, when a state of suffering is strong, when we're first learning how to turn towards our suffering, it's as if our mindfulness is kind of weak in a way. You know, our mindfulness is a kind of a weak force in the mind, and this habit of suffering, whatever it is a really practiced tendency. You know, it's often they're kind of with this kind of dukkha, the afflictive emotions that we have. We tend to have patterns around them. You know, that we've learned really well how to be angry, or we've learned really well how to be frustrated or impatient. So the kind of pattern in the mind is really strong around that strong emotion. And the, you know, bringing the your little, you know, mindfulness to this, it kind of gets swamped by the wave of that strong emotion. And so for myself, the most helpful thing, if you notice when you turn towards an emotion, trying to bring mindfulness to it, when you turn towards some strong state of suffering, trying to bring mindfulness to it, if you find it gets stronger, if it amps up, if it increases, then it's usually not a good idea to try to be mindful of it. You can try turning your attention to the body. That's often a good way to begin. You know, what's the physical experience that's happening here and now around this emotional state? But often the physical and the mental are so intertwined that even turning to the physical state just kind of amps it up also. So sometimes even that's not so helpful. So what I found for myself is that it's really helpful to cultivate some place you can go with mindfulness that's kind of neutral for you, so that you can kind of turn your attention away from that difficulty. You know, it may be challenging, if you can, to be mindful of something else in your experience. So for myself, anger being one of my big things, When I was first working with this anger, I was noticing that it would swamp my mindfulness, and so I learned pretty quickly that I needed to set it aside and put my attention someplace else. And so I picked my feet on the ground. You know, I was for some reason, in my case, often what happened is that when I was walking, this anger would come up. You know, I'd be walking and the mind would be kind of ruminating, and then it would latch on to the story, and then it would spin up, and pff, there would go the anger. And just like, okay, here I am, feet on the ground, just something really obvious, contact, contact, contact. I had enough mindfulness by that point to be able to do that, to be able to actually connect with my feet on the ground. Now, a key with this kind of saying not now, to, you know, turning away from an experience, is to not do it out of aversion. That we need to learn that that can be a compassionate response, to turn away from a strong emotion. So to try to engage in that movement of, so essentially an ignoring, to engage in that ignoring with a compassionate heart, that it's compassion that's the motivation, because recognizing or seeing that bringing the mindfulness to it just makes it stronger, we see, well, that's not a compassionate response. Let's try to find something that'll help to dissipate it a little bit. So it a big part of the work with this ignoring is to not ignore out of aversion and repression. That can be the kind of tendency, that it, when there's something strong like that, well, I can't bring mindfulness to it, I've got to repress it so that I, you know, can put my attention over here, and there's just a tightening. So if you find that kind of thing happening, if there's a tightening in order to put your attention someplace else, it might be that some kind of distraction could be helpful. I wouldn't necessarily recommend television, but something you might try, or another kind of thing you might try. Again, I really suggest neutrality when there's something like this happening. Now, you know, that you can try something like metta practice, which is a cultivation of the quality of loving kindness, cultivating the wish for yourself to be happy, the wish for other beings to be happy. And that may be something that works for some when a strong emotion comes in, to bring in, you know, okay, may I be happy? You know, may I be happy? May I be healthy? That's kind of the first. The Buddha actually recommended 5 things. I'll just go through the 5 things. I'll just do that. So the Buddha actually recommended 5 things when things are kind of overwhelming. And the first one he recommended was this kind of replacing. Replace those thoughts, those feelings, with something more wholesome. So metta is a good example. You know, strong, a difficulty comes in. May I be happy? May I be healthy? That's the kind of the weakest approach, in a sense. So if the mind is... if the mindfulness isn't very strong, that may not work. So the next one that he recommends is reflecting on the drawbacks of the emotion, or the state of suffering, the state of thinking about, particularly if there's a lot of thinking around. These teachings that I'm giving here are really related to strong, intense thinking, which is often associated with intense suffering, intense dukkha. The reactivity is so often because of a kind of a runaway chain of thought in the mind. So the second thing he recommends is actively cultivating, contemplating the drawbacks of those thoughts. You know, that, you know, for example, for me, in the state of anger at this person who is 7,000 miles away, something contemplating the drawbacks of the thoughts might be something like, well, he's 7,000 miles away, he's not getting anything, you know, he's not feeling this, but boy, I am sure feeling the suffering of this. So kind of actually reflecting on those drawbacks. The third one he recommends is this ignoring. Ignoring this kind of skillful ignoring, turning towards something else, kind of just, and in this kind of ignoring thing that I've been describing, the turning towards something, you know, feet on the ground, something neutral I find to be really, really helpful. You know, if what I found in my own experience with working with difficulty like this is that if I tried to bring in metta, it would be like that other part of my mind that was experiencing so much suffering was kind of going, yeah, metta, hop. You know, it was like, it was in such contrast to the state, it just felt like it was disrespectful. You know, it was like, you're not paying attention to me, you're trying to paper me over. You know, so that's how my mind reacted when I tried to bring in the kind of positive thoughts or positive thinking when something strong, difficult was happening. So for me, neutrality was really, really helpful. So neutral, contact of the feet. Hands are pretty neutral. Hearing is pretty neutral. If you can spend some time cultivating an awareness of something like hearing, like your hands, like your feet, it will serve you when there is some difficulty. Sometimes people think of, well, why not just go back to my breath? And in my experience, going back to the breath when there's a strong reactivity coming, so much of that reactivity is often felt in this area of the torso. And trying to bring the attention to the breathing in that situation, at least in my experience, it's like I'm already like, you know, there's a contraction in the chest and in the heart, and it's hard to breathe, and it just kind of, I'm back into the feeling. So to me, it's been really helpful to find something outside of the core of the body and allow the attention to come to settle in that place. Now, if there's still so much mental activity that you can't ignore through paying attention to some physical experience, because the mind is so active, then a kind of a distraction towards something, you know, a kind of thought that's also kind of neutral. So that you're kind of consciously bringing a thought in mind and using that as something to pay attention to. Again, something neutral. And to stay present with that, like you might bring an image of something, you know, some place that you feel comfortable, but not, you know, I don't know, some place where you feel at home or comfortable. Maybe that it is a little bit on the pleasant side, but it's not that you're constructing, oh yeah, I'm going to take this trip to Hawaii, I'm going to be on the beach, I'm going to having a nice day. So it's not that kind of construction. It's more of a neutral, just imagining yourself in a place where you feel safe, secure, comfortable. Or even at one point, I found a way to distract my mind from being kind of caught in a pattern was to just bring up some really innocuous thought. Like, I picked the most innocuous thought I could think of because I knew if I picked something like a place where I felt comfortable or friends that I felt happy with, that the mind would kind of chain off on that, you know, that there's enough of the momentum that the mind will just kind of spin out on whatever the mind brings in. So if I brought in, oh, my friend, you know, that we spent a day having a picnic together, then I'd be, oh, and we had that picnic together, and then she did that, 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 and then I'm back in my state. So to pick something, just something so completely innocuous that I could hold my attention on. And for me, I picked, this is a little embarrassing, I picked an image of Winnie the Pooh with a balloon floating over the tree with Christopher Robin underneath going, tut, tut, it looks like rain. You know that story, Christopher Robin and the bees. I just picked that image and held that image in my mind. It was so neutral. It's like, you know, I'm not going to go spinning out on Christopher Robin and Winnie the Pooh. And, you know, all I needed to do actually was hold that image in my mind for probably less than a couple minutes, and things really settled. So, there's a variety of things, of approaches. So that's through ignoring. Then the next one's a little more complicated, of these five ways to work with thoughts. Actually, I think I'll just leave it. I'll just leave those two for another time.
So I want to just ask a follow-up to that. And so that's what to do. Those are some skillful suggestions on what to do if you're overwhelmed, if the meditator gets overwhelmed. When is it skillful to just stay with the emotion and not turn away or not replace or not go to neutrality?
My sense is, and this is something each person needs to kind of explore on their own, if you can be mindful of it and it's not leading into that kind of exploding thought or an intensification of the emotion, where it gets even more, if it's not feeling overwhelming, you know, I think we all have our own sense of overwhelm. If it's not feeling overwhelming when we bring our attention to it, see if you can be mindful of it. And it may be that for a while you can do that, and then you know, so you hang out with it. Yep, okay, there's the pressure, there's the tension, and you can hang out with it for a little while. And then after some time, it starts to build again, and it starts to feel like, oh, you know, this is too much. So it's recognizing that tip to overwhelm. And when you're not overwhelmed, to just see if you can stay with it. And another skillful tool that I've found, this can give you something to do with it. So often these states of dukkha have a lot of emotional response. And so turn towards the physicality, you know, acknowledge the emotion as much as you can, you know, recognize, okay, anger or whatever it is, anger's happening. And then, so just acknowledge that in a really simple way and then turn towards the physicality. Spend some time with the body, check in with how the body responds to this feeling of anger. And then after a little while of that, a minute or so, check in again with the mind. What's the mood or state of mind now that you have, since you have been paying attention to the body? Turn back to what's happening in the mind and see if there's been a shift. Is it still anger? Or it may still be anger, it may be slightly less, or it may be something completely different. It might be fear. And acknowledging, oh, fear is happening, and go into the body, hang out with that. What's the impact of fear? Or maybe there's the anger, and then you pay attention to that, and then there's self-righteousness. You know, go back to the mind, it's like, oh, and then turning to the body, the feeling of self-righteousness is different than the feeling of anger. How does that feel in the body? And then after a few minutes of that, go back. And what's happened in the mind? To kind of go back and forth between body and mind. Because when we attend to experience, when we attend to it with mindfulness, things don't stay the same. And if we kind of just assume, oh, anger, I'm paying attention to anger and paying attention to the bodily sensations, we may actually miss that there's been a shift in the mind. And so to kind of go back and forth, that can be helpful when you're exploring something that's not overwhelming, and it gives you a sense of some of the layers, too, of how the experience is put together. Any other questions or thoughts?
As you were talking about meeting this situation, I guess it's abstract to me, and I'm trying to imagine situations, for example, at work maybe, or with my spouse, where this situation is very real, and it's sitting there in front of you. My tendency is to want to, quotes, process it, if you know what I mean. And I'm guessing, I'm trying to understand what the map looks like when you're trying to be mindful relative to that event.
As it's happening.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So that's a great question. Let me start by saying, you know, the exploration of mindfulness in daily life, essentially, as things are happening, is a really great exploration. And it's one that is fraught with a lot of slip-ups. You know, that you get involved in these conversations, and because these habits are so strong, that they take over, and, you know, it can be after the fact, before you even realize, oh, I just got really angry at her. You know, and so part of it in the engagement in daily life is a lot about being compassionate with yourself for the fact that it's really hard, and to just keep trying. So you might engage with something, you know, to pick something that you want to play with as a daily life exploration. And see if you can just keep trying to bring awareness to that over time. That just continual recognizing, you know, probably what will happen initially in daily life as you bring this, attempting to bring this mindfulness in, is that you'll find, you know, at some point, well, it depends on the explosion. I mean, it might be that the anger is, or the explosion, or the situation real time is strong enough that you kind of remember at some point when it's gotten really hard, you know, when it's gotten really big. And at that point, just as much as you can, just acknowledging to yourself, okay, this is happening. You may not be able to do much to alter your behavior at that point, but just kind of noting as compassionately as you can, yep, this situation is happening, this frustration, this annoyance, this impatience, this irritation, this anger, this rage even, you know, whatever. Just seeing if you can acknowledge it, even that lightly, you know, just even just that beginning of meeting it with just the recognition. Over time, that's extremely powerful, just that meeting with recognition, what as you can. I found over time exploring this that the resolve to continue to remember, even though, you know, it's hard and you might forget and you might miss it entirely sometimes, whenever you remember that you've forgotten, you know, you're going to bed and you think, wow, I had that happen 3 or 4 times today. At that moment, rather than beating yourself up and saying, well, this, I obviously can't do this, be compassionate with yourself and think, yep, this is hard. This is a hard thing to do. And I'm just going to keep trying. Really, with just that gentle, ooh, just keep trying.
Call my spouse that. Try for forgiveness that way.
And over time, what I found is that, you know, the remembering happened kind of sooner and sooner, and slowly over time, it began to make some inroads into the pattern as it was beginning, you know, so that it didn't spiral so much out of control. So just really a kind of a dedicated to, you know, I would start by just picking one or two things. And see, can you try to remember those, like mindfulness projects in daily life? You know, if you just say, I'm going to be mindful all day long, the likelihood is you're not going to succeed. And you're going to give up because it's an overwhelming project. But picking something a little more contained, you know, I'm going to try to be aware of this thing. And just re-engaging, you know, committing. I forgot again. I'm just going to try to remember. Just going to keep trying to remember. And in that, just that commitment, we begin to make, you know, to begin to feel into the experience. Now, you know, it is an unpleasant situation to feel, you know, when we go into these states of dukkha-dukkha. And so initially, it's not going to be pleasant. But if you can just simply recognize, yep, boy, this is unpleasant, yep, okay. So there's that aspect of it, to just keep trying. And in daily life, I found, you know, over time, it's like you can really start to see these things as they begin. You know, it's just like just feeling a little bit of a grinch, you know, a little bit of a clamping down. And seeing that clamping down, the mind can go, oh, I know where that's headed. I don't need to go there. So the practice over time begins to lead to seeing the little kind of smaller movements, so that you're not quite in such a mess. And even those times when you are in more of a mess, there has become, I mean, in this practice over time, there can become a way of learning how to kind of disengage from a difficult, complex of emotions and feelings and body sensations, and just watching it, so that there can be a sense of a little bit of distance. That, yeah, that thing can happen and be going on, but it's like there's not so much of an identification with it. And when there's not so much of an identification with it, it's much easier to just allow it to be. And in the allowing it to be, it will dissipate, because it is just a phenomenon like any other phenomenon, and it arises and passes. If we're not feeding it, if we're not continuing to feed it with our thoughts, with our the direction of our mind inclining that way, it will dissipate. And in that kind of neutral space, or in that non-identified space, essentially what we can do is just watch it just dissipate over time. And then there is another way of exploring these kinds of things, where you see in real time that it's really hard to be present. And so you might take a time when you're quiet and relatively calm to actually consciously bring up the situation in your mind, and then see at that point if you can then feel in your mind and body how you can be mindful of it now, when you're not actually interacting. I did this a couple weeks ago. Were you here for that exercise? Just a kind of a calling to mind some difficulty and then exploring.
That's why I told the story about the dream.
Yes. Yeah. So that kind of exploration you can do with something in your day, you know, that you can kind of consciously reflect back on it by calling it to mind, and then let go of the thinking about it in favor of just, okay, how has it impacted your body to even bring that situation up? And you can begin to feel into what does it mean to be mindful? And that will support you then being able to be a little more mindful when it comes up again. So it's 9:00. I will talk about the second kind of suffering next week. So thank you all.